Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Andrea Seabrook. Ken Rudin is on vacation this week, so sadly.
It is sad, except that it does give us the occasion to rejoice to have you, Andrea Seabrook, back on our podcast.
Hallelujah.
Welcome.
Actually, I'm singing hallelujah because the Senate actually shut down and adjourned for the rest of August, and so did the House.
Now, help me here, because a lot of people thought they had already done that.
Yeah.
Didn't we get rid of both chambers not very long ago?
We did not very long ago, and then not very long ago, one chamber came back, and then another chamber came back, and it seemed
sort of like,
it was like
now they all want to do it.
It's just like, yeah, what's going on here? You know, the Congress that couldn't go on vacation or something.
So the Senate actually met just shortly before you joined me here in the studio.
Yes, they did. Well,
so
the Senate,
all 100 senators,
right.
Bright and shiny faces, all in their places.
By the Senate, I mean New York's Chuck Schumer and Maryland's Ben Cardin.
Well, that covers the full spectrum from A to almost B.
Well, all you need to open a Senate session, if you have everyone's agreement that you can ask for a unanimous consent request, is somebody to sit in the chair and wield the gavel and somebody to stand at the podium and ask for the UC, the unanimous consent request, which they did. And here, let me point out, I want to correct something that Senator Chuck Schumer said on the floor today, and that is that it was House rules that forced them to come back. In fact, it was the United States Constitution that forced the Senate to come back because the Senate put a bill, this $600 million border security bill, on an appropriations template and passed it and sent it to the House. But by the U.S. Constitution, all appropriations bills must originate in the U.S. House
of
Representatives, all money bills. So it was, excuse my opining here, but the Senate's fault that this happened.
I'm always prepared to consider the idea that something might be the Senate's fault. And in this particular instance, I think that probably you raise a strong point. But they did this strictly, really, to get a $600 million appropriation for the purposes of strengthening border security, obviously a hot-button issue, obviously something everybody wants to be for in their campaign this fall. And this was essentially forced upon them because the House did something unusual. They came back in the middle of August to handle some legislation that they were forced to come back and handle because the Senate had done something unusual by passing it in the first place.
Right. $26 billion of money that would go to aid to the states, $10 billion of it to help states shore up Medicaid accounts, keep people on Medicaid rolls, most of the rest of it for teachers, firefighters, policemen, basically state governments to keep government workers employed. And this is something that almost no one back in the states I can find is against. You know, even all the Republican governors are clamoring.
Now, who's for firing teachers,
right? Are clamoring for this money because it helps them. But the debate on the floor was pretty much what you'd expect. I think only two Republicans ended up voting for it in the House.
And again, the argument was that it was fine to keep teachers, it was fine to make these Medicaid payments, but that the Democrats should cut spending somewhere else in order to offset the $26 billion, and they didn't accept the offsets that the Democrats said were legitimate pay-fors in
yes.
the bill.
Everybody sees coming down the tracks the debate over the Bush tax cuts, really. That's what's really the background for everything that's going on. And so when they talk about the pay-fors and all of this, the Democrats turn around and say, okay, if you want to have a debate about the deficit, then let's talk about the Bush tax cuts, because extending the Bush tax cuts for the upper 5% of taxpayers is going to cost way more money than the $26 billion for teachers and firefighters. So it all comes down in the end to priorities. And no one can really claim the high ground here, either on the deficit or the spending.
So while the House was back in town and meeting on the floor and had a pretty good turnout,
almost everybody came back. It was surprising because for a lot of people, I couldn't see why they would.
Well, it didn't seem terribly necessary for
the Republicans.
All the Democrats to be here, or for any, really, of
right.
the Republicans, since they were going to lose the vote.
Right.
But most everyone came back, by and large, and they came back and were, shall we say, entertained by a 37-minute, rather rambling, perhaps meandering speech by Charlie Rangel in loose defense of his own case, 13 charges against him that have been lodged by the House Ethics Committee.
Right. Remember, these are the charges that are everything from not declaring income and therefore not paying taxes on that income to using for rent stabilized apartments in the same building in Harlem.
He's only supposed to be able to have one main residence.
Right. Yes. And that constitutes
unless,
a gift because the landlord let him do it and blah, 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 blah. So there's, you know, there are a lot of charges against him here. He's been fighting them all along. He, in fact, asked for this full investigation almost 2 years ago. His problem is that, well, let's just say the House was in session for what was supposed to be a couple of hours, and he brought a point of personal privilege to the floor.
Which is that he can always defend himself against any sort of charge that's been made against his ethics, and the House has to listen.
Someone said, Charlie, they all love you. And I paused until they finished it, but they love themselves better. I understand that, you know. But for God's sake, just don't believe that I don't have feelings, that I don't have pride, that I do want the dignity that the president has said.
In the end, what he was trying to say is that he hasn't had enough of a chance to rebut these charges. And boy, he tried. He rebutted.
Then he also pointed out that the next proceeding that will be held into his case is not until September 13th, which is one day before his primary in
right.
New York. I don't think there are too many people who expect him to lose that primary, but he would just as soon not look terribly weak in it. He would just as soon win it handily and not squeak by to his latest nomination to a 21st term in the House. This is all, of course, terribly ironic because he came aboard in Congress 40 years ago as a reformer, beating Adam Clayton Powell Jr., and now he's running against Adam Clayton Powell IV.
The fourth.
All right, we've been over some of this ground in previous podcasts, but...
But wait, if we're going to talk about weird parallels, he's also just stepped down, or however you call it, as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And speaking of chairman of the powerful Ways and Means Committee who have ethics problems...
There was, of course, Dan Rostenkowski, who died this week at 82 years old after a long illness, who was a predecessor of his, not his immediate predecessor in the chair, but certainly the last Democratic chairman who mattered as much as Charlie Rangel has come to matter
yes.
as Ways and Means chairman. And Dan Rostenkowski was something of a legend in his own right. I think you'd have to say he was one of the most effective compromise legislation makers and consensus builders that the House has ever seen, made a lot of compromises with Ronald Reagan, didn't make him popular with a lot of liberals. His downfall came because of similar mm-hmm. things to these Charlie Rangel allegations. Some of them were quite petty. I mean, he had appropriated chairs from the House. He had converted some
Sorry,
of the stamps.
No,
I mean, it seems so petty.
So silly.
The man was handling billions of dollars, economy-wide impact, and he was taking sheets of stamps and converting them into cash and pocketing the cash, having people on his staff mow his lawn. And he finally reduced a long list of charges to just two, pled guilty to them, and served 17 months in a federal prison.
I personally have come to accept the fact that sometimes one person gets singled out to be held up by law enforcement as an example.
It's becoming clearer and clearer that all of these people that have these ethics violations, like Rangel, who's been in the House for 40 years, like Rostenkowski, who's in the House for a long time, are victims of a previous way that the House worked. That it was almost business as usual what these people went down for, ultimately. And in the age of constant availability of information, it's not okay anymore.
Well, and also this week, just before we learned of Dan Rostenkowski's death, we had this dramatic plane crash in Alaska. Several people were killed, including Ted Stevens, the longest-serving Republican senator in history. And he had just been defeated in 2008 after having been found guilty by a federal jury on a number of charges that had to do with personal services that were done for him and that he never declared as gifts, and that involved people that were doing business with the federal government. Charges were brought. He didn't want to negotiate. He wanted to defend himself. He took the stand. It didn't do himself any favors on the stand and was convicted. And just a few days later, after seven times he had been elected, usually with over 70% of the vote, he was defeated, narrowly defeated by Mark Begich, the Democratic mayor of Anchorage, in the fall of 2008. Now, since then, Ted Stevens had kept going great guns. He was in and out of town. He was all over Alaska.
The charges were dropped.
And the charges that he was found guilty on and that cost him his seat in the Senate were dismissed after a finding of prosecutorial misconduct. They hadn't shared all the evidence with the defense. So there were tremendous ironies in his case. But he had gone right on, at the age of 86, gone right on being, in a sense, king of Alaska, man who every time he flies to Anchorage landed in an airport that was named for him.
I'm guilty of asking the Senate for pork and proud of the Senate for giving it to me.
This was also an extraordinary case of a man who was powerful and careless at the same time about what apparently would have to be called petty corruption.
Well, yeah, and the Senate is mourning this man. Everybody in the Senate knew him. He was loved for his quirks as much as he was for his effectiveness. But the man was on a plane owned by Telco, going from a camp owned by Telco to another camp owned by Telco with a plane full of lobbyists.
And this was the environment they all lived in.
He was still running with the big boys. He was doing exactly what was business as usual for decades, if not a couple of centuries in
the House and Senate. Morton's Steakhouse in Washington, D.C. had an alcove with a little plaque on it that said Rosti's Roost, if I remember correctly. And this was where he regularly held forth with his cronies and with people from all the industries that he was writing legislation to affect.
And I have to say, though the electorate is as disappointed as it maybe has ever been, or at least in a century, I think things actually with the advent of Twitter and finding little things about these people all the time really is changing up there. People are responding to this, and they know that you can't even have the slightest ethics impropriety and keep your seat.
Well, we'll see, because Charlie Rangel is still with us. We don't know what's going to happen. I don't see an expulsion
vote
coming.
But he's not the chair anymore.
And he's not the chair of the Ways and Means Committee. Maxine Waters, another member.
Her charges are more serious.
Well, because it is something that people can take a little bit more seriously as affecting public policy.
Right.
Because she, through her grandson, who's also her chief of staff, was arranging meetings between federal regulators, the Treasury Department, at the time of the collapse of the credit industry and the banking industry 2 years ago. She was arranging a meeting between Treasury officials, very important ones, and what she said was to be a group of minority-owned banks, but the only bank that was represented at the meeting was one in which her husband owns a significant stake.
Right.
And so in the end, they wound up getting a fair amount of money, and it looks as though that was all influenced by Congressperson Maxine Waters,
right,
who is chairman of a subcommittee that is very important to the House Financial Services
Committee. The scale of that kind of allegation is a little bit different than rent-stabilized apartments or forgetting. I mean, not to make, you know, judgments on this, but the allegation there is somewhat
more troubling.
Yeah, it's somewhat more troubling.
And yet, she is maintaining that she did absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever. I mean, even Charlie Rangel is willing to say he made some mistakes of judgment. She says absolutely nothing wrong, would do it all again tomorrow, nothing to hide here, no problem. The reason you're coming after me is the same reason you're coming after most all the other people whom the Office of Congressional Ethics has gone after. We're all members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Yeah, it's very interesting, this racial flag that's being thrown by some of these members of the Congressional Black Caucus. I think it's also telling that it's not getting much traction.
Well, I heard John Lewis come out on the floor of the House and say to a number of reporters, I don't think this is about race. I don't think that this has to do with race. It has to do with what members choose to do with respect to the rules.
Yeah, and John Lewis is very careful about when race is brought into a discussion, though he often brings it in himself. He's not willing to throw it around.
You know, Andrea, the thing that strikes me always is no matter how low the national opinion of Congress goes and no matter how good the reasons are for that low opinion, it doesn't seem to reduce the number of people who want to come to Washington and be part of all this.
Yeah, it's not like their salary is getting bigger and bigger either.
No, and it's not like they're gaining any greater respect, and it's not like they're gaining greater power. And yet you have people who are willing to spend what I would describe as respectable amounts of money, even fantastic amounts of money. Jeff Green in Florida running for the Senate. Linda McMahon. Who just won her primary this week.
This is WWE woman. This is the one who kicked her husband in the crotch.
Former executive of the World Wrestling Entertainment.
Yes.
And she is already on the hook for 20-some million dollars in the Connecticut race. This is Connecticut. This is in New York. Well, and there's more money being spent in California. But on the other hand, California costs a little bit more money to advertise in with all the major media markets.
California is some large portion of the United States, whereas Connecticut
is not. And so Linda McMahon is on her way to setting some kind of per-vote record, I suspect, for a Senate seat. And yet she may not necessarily even win that Senate seat,
right,
because she's running against Richard Blumenthal, the Attorney General, the Democrat, who is still pretty popular even after we found out that he'd been fudging his record on going to Vietnam.
Right. He's still 10 points ahead of her in the local polls. And it's a fascinating race, if only because of watching Linda McMahon try and turn her public face from being about WWE and walking into the ring and doing all kinds of weird, provocative things like being hit by wrestlers
you may be seeing some of that in this fall campaign.
To a businesswoman who just ran a popular soap opera for many years. So it's very, so fascinating. Oh, my God. You can't get better than this.
Well, on the other hand, there are other states competing. we'll get around to talking about Florida when Ken gets back. But first of all, we want to mention Colorado, which was a widely followed race, partly because Michael Bennett Bennett, who was the appointed incumbent, was challenged by a former House Speaker out there in Colorado, Andrew Romanoff. And, you know, Romanoff really came on strong. He sold his house to pay for ads, and he really characterized Michael Bennett as being a guy who was too close to corporate business, who had been brought to Colorado by Phil Anschutz, a really conservative billionaire who has a lot of oil and gas interests out there, and hired Michael Bennett to handle some projects for him. He really made the guy look, I thought, terribly defensive. In the latter days of the campaign, the New York Times weighed in by criticizing a finance program that Bennett put in place for the Denver school system when he was superintendent of schools. Yeah. And yet, on primary day, when you'd think that the more liberal activists of the Colorado Democratic Party might be heard from most, Bennett wins 54-46.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very handy win.
That's a strong win for a guy who was thought to be perhaps a little bit behind or no better than tied. Some people are crediting it to a late emphasis that was put on the race by the White House and by Barack Obama, who made a teleconference appeal to Colorado Democrats on behalf of Michael Bennett and thanked him for all the bills he'd voted for in the Senate, many of which will be costing him in the fall election, I suspect. And what about the Republicans out there?
Republicans / Tea Party people. They took everything that they were trying to get in Colorado. Ken Buck beat Jay Norton in the Senate race. Mm-hmm. And in the gubernatorial race, Dan Mays, Mr. Bicycles Are an Evil Plot by the United Nations, won over Scott McGinnis.
Now, Scott McGinnis was a veteran member of the House of Representatives,
yeah.
a guy who at first was thought to be a slam dunk to get this Republican nomination.
Well-liked.
Yeah, until he got caught having plagiarized his contribution to a foundation report that he got paid several hundred thousand dollars for and apparently didn't write all of it. That really hammered him. And so he wound up losing to Dan Mays, who, as you say, has got some strange observations about life in Denver and Mayor Hickenlooper's plan for bicycles. Hickenlooper, of course, is the Democratic nominee for governor, so they're going to get to really debate bikes.
Of course, what we're talking about is John Hickenlooper, the current mayor, has been supporting bikes and, you know, because it saves energy. And he got in a little bit of trouble with some car dealers by saying, you know, how can we avoid getting in our cars? And so Dan Mays has latched on to this. But he's taken it a little farther than just don't bash the car dealers. He says that it's part of a UN plot that Hickenlooper has signed on to that has some sort of nefarious larger meaning than just bicycles.
We're doubtless going to hear a lot more about that. We're also going to hear a lot more. I was speaking of Ken Buck, the fellow who won the Tea Party endorsement, if you will. I mean, it's sort of an informal thing, but was certainly their candidate. Mm-hmm. He is a prosecutor from Weld County. He doesn't have a lot of other political experience. And he was running against Jay Norton, former lieutenant governor there in Colorado, co-chair of the McCain campaign there in 2008, very well-known and established figure. And he beat her partly because he cast this as the new rising Tea Party kind of sentiment in the state against the old establishment Republican sentiment in the state. And there was an exchange of ads in which she talked about how much she had accomplished and having done it all while wearing high heels.
Mm-hmm.
And then he made an ad in which he said, why should you vote for me? Well, first of all, because I don't wear high heels. And he meant it sort of as a joke, perhaps, and there was laughter in the ad. But I think we're going to see that come back. I think Michael Bennett is going to try to cast Ken Buck as being in some sense or another insensitive to women.
Well, I think one of the things to watch in November in all these primary races where Tea Party candidates are winning is they can win in a primary, a Republican primary, because Republicans are mad. But can they win in a general? I mean, because they have gone to the right in order to win against these. And the general electorate may not be as far to the right as the Republican Party. So that'll be interesting. And it was interesting to see that Palin, of the 10 people that she endorsed, 5 have won.
Well, also in Georgia this week, she had endorsed strongly Karen Handel, mm-hmm. who was a Tea Party kind of candidate, who had been in the state legislature, but who was seen much more as an insurgent against Nathan Deal, another former member of the United States House. And Nathan Deal had some of his own ethics issues raised against him when he was in the House, and so Karen Handel was running around Georgia calling him a corrupt relic of Washington. And yet, in the end, by 0.04% of the vote, 2,500 votes, Nathan Deal got that Republican nomination, and that was one of the ones that Sarah Palin didn't get.
And then there's Minnesota.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned Minnesota.
Mark Dayton.
Well, I don't know if we're going to have Mark Dayton back or not, but Mark Dayton served one term in the United States Senate from 2000 to 2006, decided it wasn't for him, went back home, but now he decided he wants to be back in politics, ran in a three-way race, and just barely won the nomination there.
For governor.
For governor of Minnesota. And he's going to be running against another hero of the new energy on the Republican side, Tom Emmer. It'll be an interesting matchup.
Mm. And then for the rest of the summer, I get to run around and chase members of Congress and senators or would-be senators. I'm on my way to Delaware soon, which is a really fun, interesting race. We've got a Tea Party candidate in the primary. We've got Mike Castle, who is as far from a Tea Party candidate as you can get. They're both running for the Senate seat that was left by Joe Biden, now the vice president. And you know, it's thought to be one of the races that could actually flip a seat in the Senate from Democrat to Republican. I think it'll be interesting to see that, because if you gain a Mike Castle in the Senate, you gain a Susan Collins or an Olympia Snowe. This is a moderate Republican, a breed that barely exists anymore, and so it'll be interesting. That's an interesting race to watch. And, you know, I'll be running around.
And we'll be watching you. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Andrea Seabrook.
And I hope we can have you back very soon.
I'll be here.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.